Hello, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Welcome back to Aces Up the Sleeve. I'm Patty, co-hosting with the co-managing partner of Pocket Aces Racing, or PAR for the quick reference, Jared Shoemaker. And in this little podcast, we're going to shed light on all things Pocket Aces. We're going to talk about the finer points of syndicate ownership. We're going to discuss what you all, the listeners, the viewers, the partners, the fans have asked us to talk about. And since we are industry participants, we're going to talk about the industry at large. And today we are joined by Buff Bradley, who is a retired Breeders' Cup winning trainer. And he also now works for Keeneland as part of their sales development team. Before we get going into it, Buff, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
He's slammed busy. He's got 4,000 horses coming onto the grounds over the next 2 weeks that they got to get ready. And however many countless buyers, I don't have any idea how many people come through to buy, and consigners and grooms and just the, I mean, it's a small little city coming into the grounds over the next couple of weeks. So he's busy.
So in this week's edition, we are going to sit down with Buff, who is going to talk a little bit about what got him into racing. And by and large, we're going to kind of focus on this Keeneland September sale since it is coming up. It's a huge deal, but we do want to know a little bit about, you know, your background, Buff, and how you got into racing. We are going to talk just a little bit about kind of what the sales development position looks like, especially, I know some of our newer listeners, some of our newer viewers might not entirely know kind of what goes on with that. So we'll just jump right into it. Buff, if you just want to start with just a little bit of an introduction, a little bit of a background, and just tell us how you got into racing, and we'll just go from there.
Right. Okay. Well, my parents had bought a farm when I was a child, and I was always out on the farm riding the ponies, and that's how I got my name, Buffalo Bill, jumping on the ponies and riding them around. So it got shortened down to Buff. I always wanted to do that. And we were breaking horses there and on the farm. We had a little bit of a 3/4 mile track and did that for quite a while. Then I went to college, graduated college with a business management degree, and then went straight to the racetrack and worked for Clarence Piku for 5 years. And probably a lot of people would know that his daughter, Susie Oldham, who's married to Johnny Oldham, and Jessica Stith, that are in the horse business as well. But I worked for Clarence, and when I came back to, we were in the Midwest, and when I came back to Kentucky, my dad started buying some horses for me to train, and a few horses there. So that's kind of how I've got into it, was following my parents and what their ownership of the racehorses, and just doing that. And then, you know, my dad wanted to step up and buy a few better horses, because his horses at the time were really only competitive at Mountaineer Park. So he did, and we were able to raise some good horses, and I got in with them on some, and we were very fortunate to have a couple nice horses. I left, when I graduated college, I went to the racetrack and worked for Clarence Piku. He has his daughter, Susie Oldham, who's in the horse business, and his granddaughter, Jessica Stith, and Johnny Oldham, married to Susie. So they were all in the business as well. So that's how a lot of people around Kentucky would know them. But once I worked for Clarence for about 5 years, and then went out on my own, started training for John Franks, and my dad went to Keeneland Sales and bought a few horses, and we happened to be very fortunate with them. So it was a good run for training, and I enjoyed my training career, but towards the end, it was ready for me to move to something different.
Yeah, so I know this kind of story about how you ended up going to Keeneland, but you did eventually transition to Keeneland, working in the front office. And so tell us a little bit about your your role now? Because I know you, and just you know, how you kind of wore them down, and you kind of convinced them that they couldn't live without you. Is the story that's kind of how I interpreted the story that we talked about
right
the other day. But tell us a little about your role and what you do there now.
All right, yeah, it's development is what they call it, and it's do a little bit of everything there though. It's we do some stuff in racing as well, and it's I guess really my job is to help on the recruiting end of things in the sales office, recruiting good fillies and mares. We have a very good sales team, and so I do a lot of outreach as well, and try to get a pulse on things from farms and consigners and trainers and owners to take back to Tony Lacey, the vice president of sales, and Cormac Brainuck, who is the director of sales. So I try to, you know, try to keep them informed of what's going on out on the farms and in the barnyard, really just kind of giving them information as well. And a lot of it is building relationships and finding out what people need. And so I do a lot of farm calls and going out and looking at yearlings and weanlings and some mares. We look at about everything. So, you know, that's a lot of the job is really outreach.
So you kind of just, you know, we think of the sales, and you've got September for 2 weeks and November for 2 weeks and January for a week. And then a couple, I guess one day in April, but I mean, you're working right. The sales year round, essentially on your.
Yes. And it's full time. I mean, when you're working the sales and you're always looking at the next sale, and it's like, as soon as we got done with September, we're working on November, and you're always working on November, even when you're doing September, and we're working on, you know, next year already, and the weanlings and the yearlings. And that's kind of, you know, when we get done with the yearling inspections, which I go on the yearling inspections as well. And that's 6 or 7 weeks of really trying to grade these yearlings so we put them in the right spots for the sales.
About how many do you guys inspect physically?
I think we look at about 3,000 yearlings, and there's two teams of us and four people on a team. Wow. And grading these horses, and it's very involved, and it's a lot more than what people think. You know, it's all scheduled and laid out for you. And so during the day, we might go visit several farms and look at several horses on each farm. And we all just jump in the cars first thing in the morning and take off. But when we grade them, you know, there's not much talking while we're looking at them. And we're just trying to find the best physical and figure out where they might fit. We get back to the office late afternoon, and we'll discuss every one of the horses that we've looked at that day. And we could look at 50 to 100 a day, each team separately. So we're really kind of trying to get a consensus on the grade and where that horse might go. And a lot of the, when we're looking at these yearlings, we have the sire and the dam and the grand sire, but that's it. I mean, we don't really have a whole lot more information than that. So we're not looking at a pedigree. We're looking at, you know, so we'll know what an Uncle Mo looks like. You know, when we see an Uncle Mo, we know that's an Uncle Mo. So, but, so we can, and we can kind of gauge like, oh boy, I really liked certain sire this year, you know, that come about that, you know, boy, his babies look really good. But that's the reason that we have that. Or if we are thinking, well, that's what an Uncle Mo should look like. You know, it's, that's how we would judge that. But then we get the grade, and then that's put in the system.
Yeah,
and then we'll,
like a candy ride. You know.
Yeah. You know,
like a candy ride, you know, they never did look that great. Mark would always say, man, if I ever saw a really good looking candy ride, I'd be scared to death of it. So you got to know that. So that you know that, you know, just because it doesn't look perfect, maybe it doesn't check all those boxes, that might just be what that sire throws. And And that's okay. And it can still earn a spot in one of the early books or, you know, up toward the beginning of the sale.
Correct. So that's very true. And, you know, we're always wanting to try to find the best physical that we can put forward and convince that the consigners or the owners that, hey, this is where this horse needs to go. And I'll tell you what, I don't do the final placements, but Cormick and Dean Rothmeyer and Tony Lacey, they're working on it, and they look at every horse, and they're really trying to do the very best on having the very best there. But that's why we're looking at the physical too, and that's why we want to know that horse belongs in that book.
So I guess I was always under the impression that you weren't looking at nearly that many horses. And I kind of thought it was like, you know, the select few at the top to determine which ones made it into books one and two. I had no idea that you all were looking at 3,000 plus horses.
Yeah, it's 3,000 out of 4,000 plus horses in the sale. So we know that, and, you know, the consigners have some say in that as well. They've got their wish list and know about where their horse belongs. But, you know, Cormick and those guys are looking at the big picture and, you know, how many Uncle Mo's do we put in this book, and how many, you know, we want the best Uncle Mo's to be in book one, say, and I'm down the line, you know, so we don't have them all in the same book and everybody's trying to figure that out. So, I, you know, it is, like I said, it's more involved than what most people think, but it's that going out and looking at the farms and seeing the horses and seeing the physicals, it's really pretty neat. And it's, you know, for all my years of training, I never looked at saying, I use Uncle Mo a lot just because that's just an easy one to know. But, you know, it's not like I would know when a horse walked in my barn that, hey, that's got to be an Uncle Mo. But when they pull him out of the barn now, I kind of know. You know, so I've looked at so many now of the different sires, I can almost say, oh yeah, that's a Munnings, that's a Uncle Mo, that's an Into Mischief, and there are different characteristics of them, and seeing the certain types, and it's really, it's as many yearlings as I've looked at over the years and purchased with my father and stuff, this is a whole different game. And you look at one that comes out, you know, you're not looking at it to say, oh, I don't want that one, or that one's not good. I mean, we're going to sell it. We got to figure out where we're going to sell it. And it just because it doesn't maybe look as well to me, it somebody else might like it a lot more. You know, there's different things that people are looking at, but we're just trying to figure out where the best horse goes.
Now, have you all always, or at least since you've been there or even before, you know, have they always looked at that many horses?
I believe they've looked at quite a few, but I don't really know how many they used to look at.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it's, I think it's something that Tony and Cormick really believe in, and I understand that this is something that we need to do so that our clients and our buyers aren't coming there. And, you know, they know what they're coming for. They know exactly that we're going to have the best horses there for them on this day. And the book one horses are book one horses. The book two horses are book two horses. And you know about when you need to be there, you know, and what you're going to have to sift through to get to what you want.
So something Patty and I were talking about, and we've noticed, I think especially I've noticed, I feel like over the last couple of years, you're looking at the back ends of the sale. I feel like there's more quality in you know, book four, five, and six, maybe than what we used to see. It seems like some of that's getting spread out, and we're certainly seeing some big name sires in the back of in these back end books that we used to not see as much. Has that been a conscientious effort, or is it just how they've graded out?
It's kind of how they graded out. But there's a lot of good horses. Like you said, I tell people all the time, we've got some pretty good horses, even in book six, and it really might fit their budget as well, you know, is what they're looking for, where they normally might have been looking in a higher, you know, in a lower book number and have had to move down a book or up a book. And I think our even our later books are got some, quite a bit of value to them.
Yeah, and we've definitely gotten some value out of those you know, the last three books over the years.
Right.
I remember we bought one, the first one through the ring on the last day of the sale was a Storm Temple Pilot, and she was a tiny little thing, but man, she ran her eyeballs out every time, and she won four or five races for us, and you know, $125,000, something like that. And you know, you last morning of the sale, there's quality everywhere, and all throughout that sale. And you know, we tell people, you know, we don't even start until you know, the second Monday, and I don't even know if we'll get anything done the second Monday or Tuesday this year. We may be looking at Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. It's just I don't know. I'm expecting a pretty strong sale for the sellers, certainly at the top end. What do you all have any kind of, you know, estimates or, you know, I would say best guesses at this point?
You know, just from the team talking and everything, we're expecting a pretty good sale. I mean, I think we're pretty optimistic that things are going to go well for us and for the sellers. And, you know, for the buyers, we've got great purses that we're running for now. As you know, Kentucky Downs, I think you probably like that place a little bit, but it's the way the purses are, you can purchase some of these horses and take a chance on these horses.
Oh yeah, just all across the state. I mean, every track in Kentucky is just the change over the last few years. I mean, you know what Turfway Park used to be like—a maiden 30 run for $9,000 purse. It was a nightmare,
right?
And you know, everybody had to go south for the winter. But you just don't have to do it anymore. And I think you're right. It's made people much more aggressive in terms of when they're going out making their purchases, when they're claiming horses. There's a demand for racehorses out there to this day. And I think it's in huge part because of the purse structure changes here in Kentucky. And certainly, you know, New York is getting stronger. It's always been strong, but it's getting stronger. It's just such a high demand for racehorses now. And whether it's claiming, buying them at auction, buying, you know, yearling auction, weanling auction, you know, 2-year-old auction, it's just there seems to be a huge, huge demand for horses. And it's great. I think it's great for the business. Now, I do think something that I think I've seen more of the last couple years than in previous years, it does seem like, you know, the high end, the top end especially, the sale, you know, it's really, really strong. Then there's some in the middle that's a little, it's not that it's not strong in the middle, but it just seems like, you know, they'll go all in for the things at the top. The middle maybe kind of drops down a little bit, and then there's a lot maybe, you know, on the lower end. If sometimes things just really aren't spot on, it seems like sometimes you can get stuck with the horse despite the demand. Do you see any differences in that since you've started?
No, not really. I mean, I think you know, maybe the middle market is a little harder to see. I think the good horses they're selling big anyhow. They're going to sell big. And, you know,
yeah, absolutely.
I still see a lot of the middle market is there's still some value there with, as you said earlier, the way the purses are in Kentucky. I think you can, you know, for the buyer standpoint, that they can get something there and be very productive with it.
So, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we're all excited. You know, if anybody has listened to me talk before, you know, this is my favorite time of the year coming out to the sales, and we're going to have you're going to see me out there a lot, Buff, before we start buying. We're going to have a little video series that we're going to put up on the webpage and all that. So, you know, we're super excited about it. Can't wait to get out there, and you know, I'll probably be out on Sunday, just start looking around and checking things out, and certainly be there when the first horse goes to the ring on Monday. And, you know, so I know you're super busy. I know you guys got a lot going on. If you could give us a couple of your favorite Keeneland related memories and then maybe one horse that you trained, or if you got one, or one or two horses that you trained during your career that just you just to this day hold a very special place in your heart?
Well, I got, yeah, that would probably take me an hour to get through all the horses that I really enjoyed being around and training. And, you know, I've had some very, like I was telling you earlier, I'm very fortunate with having bred some good ones with my father, Brass Hat, probably winning the Sycamore at age 9 there at Keeneland was very special to us. That was his, the last race he ran in, but he won at age 9. And that was pretty cool. And Calvin Burrell rode him that day. So it was, that was very memorial. Groupie Doll winning the TCA there. Very cool. I mean, and then coming back and selling her there after her second Breeders' Cup win was pretty special. The player winning the Haggard Fayette there was cool because I really like the player. He's been one of my favorites. Quirky horse. He's just a cool horse to be around. Mm-hmm. But several others there. But those are probably three of my big ones that I've had a lot of fun with and with the family.
And those are some big names. You had some fun horses. Oh, absolutely. Yes, there's no bigger thrill for me, for sure. I mean, you and I've talked about it a lot over the last couple of years. So,
yeah, we did. And it's always fun to win at Keeneland. Yeah, I grew up just 25 minutes down the road from Keeneland, and so it's been very special. I have a picture in my house that of myself at Keeneland with my parents in the winner's circle in 1972. So it's pretty cool.
Yep. That is amazing. So one final question. We're going to let you get back to your important work at hand. So let's say you are king for a day. I ask this of everybody, and I've loved hearing all of the answers that I've gotten over the years. Or over the last couple of years that we've done this, or however long we've been doing this podcast now, you're king for a day, and you can make any change to North American racing that you want. And you just wave your magic wand, and we've made the change. What's that change that you would make?
For racing in general or Keeneland? What are you asking there?
Just the thoroughbred industry. The thoroughbred industry, whether it's racing, whether it's breeding, you know, just anything in our industry, if you could make a change, what would that be?
You know, Jared, really, I think the change has really already been made that I always wanted for it to happen was that we have more people involved in our sport and more people to become aware of what's going on in our sport. And I really think the partnerships really have been a big boost to that, and such as yours and the My Racehorse. You know, some of these partnerships out there have really kind of helped get the knowledge out there to some of these people and letting them invest a little bit. And I always enjoyed racing for some partnerships, and it wasn't until later that I really got to train for some partnerships that were bigger, and I'm just saying like 10 people, because then they branch off and they want to get their own. Once they learn, after they've had their 10%, then they're really excited and they kind of know what's going on and want to be more involved. And I found that most people that were in these partnerships really enjoyed it and really loved it and were able to say, hey, my horse is running Saturday, you know, and tell, you know, they go and tell everybody my horse is running Saturday, not mine and Jared's and Mark's and, you know, going through a list, but, you know, it's my horse. And when my horse does not hit the board and make the money, well, at least I'm sharing it with Jared and Mark and everybody. But when it wins, it's my horse.
Right. You know, I think that's great. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about this previously. You know, it's, you know, we're business competitors with all those other groups. You know, we're all competing for the same people to come and join us on our horses. But at the same time, you know, I think that it's been a tremendous opportunity for racing as a whole to bring in new fans and to bring in new owners. And like you said, because a lot of times, and we've got several owners that have joined us over the year in small percentages, and now they own horses on their own, or they own, you know, horses with three other people. And so, you know, it's just whatever all of those partnership groups can do to get more people involved, I think it's definitely a good way to go. So definitely appreciate those.
No, absolutely. And I think, yeah, that's why I say, I think a lot of these groups, and such as yours yourself, I think it's really good. And it's good for you all to have those groups out there and everybody trying to build our sport a little bit more. And I think that's how you build, is to get people involved. And because out of all those people that might be in your group, how many people do they talk to, and how many people do they tell about their horse running and being excited about it? It's about, like, you know, I went to the Reds game or something, you know. You just, you know, you talk to people about stuff. So it's fun. It's fun sport to follow. And
oh yeah. And it's, you know, we always have partners that, you know, they own, you know, a smaller percentage of the horses, but they've got, you know, on race day, they've got themselves and five of their friends that they'd also like us right to get tickets for, because they want to bring their friends and their family to enjoy it with them. And then hopefully that brings even more people into it. Yeah. So it's just, we got to keep doing what we're doing and keep growing. And we're going to start that by buying some new horses in the next couple weeks.
All right. Go buy you some Champions.
There you go. Well, Buff, so much. Thank you so much for your time. Like I said, we both know you're busy. We really appreciate you carving out a little bit to do this with us. And best of luck over the next couple of weeks. Look forward to seeing you out there.
Well, thank you both, and I'll see you at the sales, and we'll catch up. Sorry, our internet wasn't better here. I don't know why it wasn't working as well, but anyhow. Well,
clearly it was on all ends. So this is going to be a challenge for Patty to navigate in the editing room, but she'll figure it out. That's she's good at what she does. So Patty, take us on home. She's talking. We can't hear her. We're having a hell of a time. So Patty's talking. Anyway, she's talking, but we're not hearing her. So thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks for joining us this week. Make sure you subscribe, you check us out on all across of our social media platforms, our YouTube channel, where, as I say, we got a lot of stuff coming, a lot of stuff we're planning, and check out all our socials, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and everybody make good choices this weekend, as Patty always says. Podcast is out.